This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I was recalling overnight, I didn't sleep much until about 3 o'clock in the morning. I was recalling what I should be saying to introduce this, and after that presentation of GIF, I just feel so humble. But one of the things that Hal Walker, the National Geographic photographer, said in writing about the expedition, he wasn't quite sure. He was very unsure of himself, of going out with all these scientists. But when we were on the expedition, he remarks that we were like little kindergarten children playing in sand pits, enjoying our own little sand bit, every now and then, of course, communicating with the others and getting us all integrated. And that's how that period of working on our own specialties and then getting it all together and over the points. And this cooperative work that was done spread through the Fulbright Foundation established in Australia between the United States and Australia in the year after the expedition. The UNESCO got onto the UNESCO Arid Zone Research Program initially between Australia. I was cooperative to promote it within Australia and the United States, and it spread all over the world in the Arid Zone studies. Then that was through the 1950s. Then we went on to the 1960s, after the International Geophysical Year in 1958, I think, when we put up the satellites and got all and did all sorts of wonderful things. The Russians put up the Sputnik, of course, that was the time. The biologists from the International Council of Scientific Unions sponsored the International Biological Program, which went on with more cooperation in dealing with the landscape, the marine environments. That was all expanding this idea of cooperation. And we went on into the International Biological Program, MEDICOS program, the biome program of the United States, etc. And I have a feeling that this Arnhem Land expedition was kind of a focus for this expanding horizon of international cooperation and between many, many different scientists. And of course, it went on to the Geosphere Biosphere program, which was dealing with global warming and is still going on. Thanks, we have this. Now, Mountford, I said to you, we talked about the conflicts between the not the anthropologists so much, but between Elkin and the amateur ethnologist Mountford. Mountford, of course, after the expedition, had to personally compile all Peter Bassett Smith's footage, make three films, which he pursued. He went up to on another national expedition to a National Geographic expedition to the Tiwi Islands. He was writing books on these, and then of course he promoted these, got the publications of four, he thought five volumes on the results of the expedition, published by Melbourne University Press. And of course, this occupied his time, and he was being pestered by you know, these poobahs at the top that didn't think he was good enough for doing these things, but he was doing it. And eventually, he decided he'd go off to Cambridge. He got and do a BA and eventually get an MA. I was helping him very peripherally. I helped him with a bit with the nutrition group, the publications from the nutrition group. But we also, I had to get off the botanical volumes and biogeographical volumes in volume 3. And then Mountford went off to Cambridge, and he said we had moved to Melbourne or transferred to Melbourne, and my wife had to plough through preparing the zoological volume, which we did all this in our spare time. Anyhow, what we have today is that I am trying to say what did we, the 8 members, that's roughly right, the scientists of the expedition, what did we try to find? And I'm, of course, biased because it's my work. What was that? No, it's just going forward all the time. Yeah, well, of course, botanical specimens, I had to be prepared with £200 of newspaper. And so we had all this garbage had to be taken out in the field. I was asked to collect every plant I could possibly find at each of the sites and in the different levels. And in the different plant communities, ecosystems, as we now know them. But by the time I went, there were 10 places in the world were keen to get samples of this unknown place, they thought. Anyhow, that was going to Leiden in the Netherlands, Kew in England, the Smithsonian, to the Arnold Arboretum that had the Archbold expeditions before the war and afterwards through from the Solomon Islands, New Guinea, down and finally in 1948 down to the Cape York. Anyhow, we got up there with all the other much more equipment needed for. And during my time, I collected, as you can see there, about 735 taxa, we call them species and varieties because they're different forms. A couple of one native pine and one cycad. 20 ferns. And going out with Bob Miller, I was particularly interested in the collecting samples of all the marine seaweeds, and that included the foundation. The coralline algae, the hard, rocky algae that form the basis and build up the structure of the coral reef. And as well, I had to get tiny desmids. You'll see about these later on, the pond weeds that were just stuck around. But one of the things, if we go back, why were there no... I'm asking questions, and I'm leading them because these questions have taken 50 years sometimes to answer. That was the heritage. We had to ask questions. And we asked one question. I'm not going to answer it here. You can copy it down, and we can talk about it afterwards. Why are there so few mosses and lichens in my collection? I, as part of my ecological thing, had to not only collect all the plants, freshwater, marine, and land, but we had to try and map the vegetation around the place. Well, with aerial photographs and working across Arnhem Land, we certainly this grey area, you can see it yourself, is all the sandstone, this wonderful place that made Arnhem Land so important. But then there's this green stuff, the eucalypt forest, which was fairly widespread. And actually, it went from Cape York right over to the Kimberley. And the sandstones were right over into the Kimberley, Western Australia. Here, I rushed too much. Here's the sandstone on the western side of Arnhem Land. Here is the sandstone on Bickerton Island. I didn't ever get into... Well, I went through the sandstones of Groote Island. And one of the things that had been... just as I left to go up on the expedition, the government botanist of the Queensland Herbarium, Cyril White, said to me, you must read Joseph Hooker's introductory essay to the flora of Tasmania. Now, Joseph, 150 years, Darwin wrote his famous work. Joseph Hooker had been down on the Erebus and Terror exploring the Antarctic. He got up to Tasmania, he did an intensive study, but at the same time, or just before, about 10 years before, the Gregory expedition was organised to try and find Leichhardt. And the remarkable Germanic botanist, my name's Germanic, but don't worry about that, Ferdinand von Müller, got himself on as the botanist on that expedition. And while he was up in the eastern Kimberley, they had 3 months there, and von Müller collected so many plants from the sandstone of there. And all this material was sent back to the Hooker's father and son in Kew, in the British Museum. And what they said of the collection, there were 200 plants which they thought in the Kimberley, that's this dot over on the Western Australian side, were identical or almost identical with the 200 plants that were found in the sandstones of the Bengal and central India. And they were the specialists in the world. Well, I was told about this just before I left, and part of my intensive collection, I had to make as many as possible. I found those 200 plants. I said, look, why aren't they in between? I had to do many years of searching through the literature, sending material and questions to Kew and Leiden, to the Archibald Expedition, Herbarium, etc. And they're not in between. They're just stranded. Why are they stranded? And why aren't they doing? And then around the sandstone, we ask the question, did I have this one? Oh, sorry, I'm pushing these things. Ah, I still miss. That's it, I've just do it too long. In the sandstone, the Flinders goes to Chasm Island, 1803, and he finds all these wonderful cave paintings, rock art. Who did them? Well, Giff has given us some idea. Over it on the Owen Pelly side, the western side of Arnhem Land, we see these stick figures again. These stick figures were used as the logo for the Olympic Games in Melbourne. They were running across the landscape. Fantastic. I did never see these, but Mountford and McCarthy were recording. Now, there was one in the collection, and Giff will be pleased with this. Were these stick figures doing giant kangaroos? Well, at least there's one in the Mountford collection. Now, who did those figures? Well, Giff has got some idea of the dating, and we have now. But what about the X-ray paintings over in the Western Arnhem Land? This group of people were quite different from the Mimi people. They came in later, and they decided they knew all about the hearts and lungs and the vertebrae. They'd include that sort of information. Here's Goanna and some other thing. You can see all these X-ray paintings. Who did these? When did they come into Australia? And these were the big questions that we were asking. Now, then we come to the green part of that original thing, the eucalypt forest. Now, here we have this extensive area of Darwin stringy bark and such forth, with cycads and palm trees underneath, and in normal seasons there's quite a lot of grass, which the Aborigines used to fire every 3 years, according to Dave Johnson, and my colleagues subsequently have proven this to be a fact, so that they can harvest the kangaroos and such forth initially during the fire, and then let the small animals come back and multiply. And every 3 years they could put a fire through it. And they controlled and managed fires. This was the eucalypt forest. That was the previous one was at Yirrkala. Here's one at Umbacumba. Much more sand in the area, so there's more dense understory. Now, when it comes back, this, you've all heard of the bauxite mines at Gove and in Arnhem Land, and also at Weeper on Cape York Peninsula. You see this, what is called the Gondwanan laterite. And it extends from the big Amazon basin right across Africa through India and Australia. And I've been working both on the sandstones of the Adelaide Hills and also the laterites of the Adelaide Hills and the grasslands of the Adelaide Hills before I went to Arnhem Land. So this was asking the question, was the vegetation with the animals all going back 50 to 100 million years? And we asked the question, those sandstones, have they changed much? Well, also we get into the freshwater swamps. And this is, and that photograph was taken on Bickerton Island, where Margaret MacArthur, and I went with Margaret MacArthur, and unfortunately with a Native Affairs officer called Howard Coates, but we won't go into that. We were visited by the Church Missionary Society. They're all this saga of what happened. But fortunately, and this was the only 2 weeks, really, pardon me, on which I had a native guide. And that was Kumbiala, the one on the left. He was 6'3", a great man, and he was from Woodar Island, connected with Fred Gray from the early days. He had come across to Umbacumba, and he had married a Groote Eylandt girl, so he was bilingual. And he was able to tell me the names in the Yolngu language and the Groote Eylandt language of all the plants that he knew and we were gathering, that were used by the Aborigines, not for, by the indigenous people in Arnhem Land or that northeastern side and into Groote Eylandt throughout. It was a remarkable coincidence that I had someone to help me, but only for that time. And one of the things I did with Kumbiawa was to kind of run out transects, what is called lines, and in every 100 metres, 100 paces, or yards, I suppose we call them in those days, or paces, and Kumbiawa helped me do this map. Now, the interesting thing that 2 weeks ago, the Australian Journal Austral Ecology, we re-examined the species richness of this map. And it's all because Kumbiawa was helping me. I thank him for it, and he made me, I think, a member of the Water Island Clan, which I'm very pleased to be. Now, as well, with working with Margaret MacArthur and the other members, we started to work out all the food sources. And in 1999, we put it all together. And so up here, there's December up here, and you can go down and say, yes, they'll be collecting yams and tubers, they get some fruits, maybe you can get some turtle eggs, turtles and eggs, mangrove crabs, and land animals. I'm over here in May, you can see yams and tubers, fruits, terminalia nuts or something, parrot fish, Venus tick something fish, salmon, etc. And we are able to see how you have to move around either the season changes. We are able to extend this because there's a lot of work that Frank Fenner and the team on the anthropological work into Central Australia. We are able to do this around the Coorong, and we have these published in our book. But it was all thanks to being on the expedition and being able to work together. Information coming in from different sources, the fishman and the so-and-so, the Aborigines telling us things, and I just put them all down into notebooks and such, and we can then integrate it. Now, of course, the black soil plain with the magpie geese and such forth were remarkable. Water lily lagoons like the lotus lily at Red Lily Lagoon at Owen Pelly, and I was asked to collect pond water. Go into these swamps amongst the reeds and get the reeds and strip them down with my hands into a kind of a little container, and then preserve a sample in formalin in a little tube. And they were sent off, these samples were sent off to New Orleans, way back to a remarkable man we won't talk about. I mean, I got a lot of leeches in this place, but never mind. What I did get was what this man in New Orleans wanted, these freshwater desmid algae. And I don't know whether that photograph is good, but the symmetry. Yeah. What? Oh, sorry. Thank you. The symmetry of these unicellular algae, they split down the middle every couple of days and form another bit. And they do this all the time, and they spread out. Now, where are they? And when I got the information back from New Orleans within a few years, this man was an authority on the desmids from Finland to Del Fuego. He knew all the places. He said, look, most of the samples have only 10 to 25, and that's roughly what we all get from any place in the world. But in this Red Lily Lagoon, there were 164. Why? Why? Well, I can tell you, but I'm not going to. You can tell me. Then I got into, at one stage, we went down to Port Bradshaw, and this great sand dune system right down from Cape Arnhem in the northeastern corner has no trees on it. It's got this low thing. I put in this one because this is to show the background of at Yirrkala. You can see on that side, there was just no trees on the sand dune. Well, these wonderful boys, I don't know who they were, but I did take the photograph. Mostly I didn't take Aboriginal photographs. I couldn't spare my films to on really worthwhile, interesting things. So I asked, why are there no trees on this coastal dune? They have a limestone core, and that core has been derived from the coralline algae, the hard coralline algae that form the basis of the coral reefs at Yirrkala and elsewhere off the coast. These are questions. Those questions took 20, 30 years to answer. I only had this photograph of the rainforest. I'd climbed up the lookout tower. You ready on this? This one was from Nightcliff. It's all under in Darwin, a suburb of Darwin. It's now all under forest. Is that stopping? Good show. And we asked, why did these little pockets of rainforest vegetation occur right across the top? Well, this is not a good slide, but we had to go and do very detailed studies over 10, 15 years of soil-water balance and throughout characteristic plants of Australia. And one of the things we find, on the left side, that's right, this side, soils are very shallow, they don't hold much water, and the trees don't get very tall. They're about 10 metres or thereabouts. But as we get deeper and deeper soils, we trap more water, and the trees get bigger until they're about 25 metres under the ideal situation in this area. But if we have seabeds coming into the area, then the water is supplemented. The natural rain is supplemented. And then we get right in the right. I'm sorry about the slide. I should have got my daughter to improve it. But she's always the power of strength, needless to say. And there is the rainforest. It's shorter, but it's very well multi-structured. And just before it, just at the edge, we have these giant eucalypts. And that's characteristic of all from Tasmania up to Cairns, North Queensland. We don't have the giant eucalypts like that in Arnhem Land. We only have the early bit, and then we jump straight into the little rainforest pockets. But people work for years saying, oh, it's fire. It's not fire. It's what we hypothesized was due to water seepage into the area. And then we asked, why? Because I'd worked in southern Australia around Adelaide and the Adelaide Hills. And we knew a lot about South Australia and people over in Victoria and New South Wales and Western Australia, of course. Knew a lot about the structure of forests and little rainforests and woodlands and getting out drier areas. And there, if you don't worry about the species, they look exactly the same in the north. Why should they be up in the monsoonal north of Australia the same in appearance as the ones in the southern part? Those are questions that had to be asked, and we've answered them. Well, then we look out, because every time I went out collecting, again, this is a poor slide, but every time I went out collecting, I'd go into a particular area, I'd have to collect everything. I knew that I would only get about 40 to 50 plant species in any site. It was almost the same in every site I went to, say for the eucalypt forests. And then, unfortunately, the terrestrial zoologists, they were too busy just collecting and getting the samples ready to go back to the Smithsonian. It was a tremendous job, as you saw, preparing the pelts to be taken back and prepared. And all this thing, but we didn't get around to saying
how many little small vertebrates, mammals, how many birds would be in each of these sites. I was able to say, yes, we'll only find 40 to 50 plants. Anyhow, subsequently, my colleagues in the CSIRO have been going across the north and finding how many plants and how many small mammals, it's top one, are in each of the small stands. We expanded it down to southern Australia, and you can see this lower line tells the work we did on the southern Australia. And so we find a remarkable correlation. Why all the time we're asking new and new facts? Why are there... And then another thing. Why were most of my new plants found in the drainage channels of the Arnhem Land quartzite expedition? Why did... Now... But they weren't... I didn't collect anything. Yes, right. And so we come completely to the point. We ask questions all the time. Why did evolution occur? Why were these things from India and Australia exactly the same, etc.? But why were we getting there? I've been working about 40 sites from Cape York to southwest. I don't find them. But one of the things that happened quickly... In 1975, they were starting the Ranger Uranium Inquiry, and I was subpoenaed to go there, and the panel asked me, look, you've just done a conservation survey of the whole of Australia and New Guinea, but why aren't these Arnhem Land communities in it? Well, I said, well, they belong to the indigenous people. It's not the whites, Balanda, to look after them. So they created Kakadu National Park, which a lot of you know, for the tourists. But a few months ago, the indigenous Aboriginal land, the Arnhem Land Aboriginal Reserve, called the Warrikan Indigenous Protection Area, was created, and there's another one, I think, down the Catherine Gorge. I think that's all. Yes. So, thank you for boring part.
Questions, comments, identify yourself.
Now, because they asked me when I was in California to recognise the Australian tree, one lot at Santa Cruz, that's what they call the Botanical Garden, I recognised those trees. And one lot at Los Angeles. How did they get there? That's what I want to know.
Well, the eucalypts were planted, even on the Berkeley, Calycanthus. That's a remarkable set of eucalypts. They were planted as they were in Israel, in Rome, to drain the swamps, help drain the swamps. I don't know where the Californian ones, but they got in quite long. And they're now part of the tradition. They didn't come back in these days of 50 million years ago and such forth. But my wife and I went to San Diego Zoo. We were working there, and we found a jungle fowl, a brush turkey. Scrub turkey called, and they were in this bound building, a little cage, and I asked the curator, look, I've got them in my garden in Brisbane, they're really invading the site, when I came back about 3 years later, they weren't there in the cage. And I said to the curator again, what's happened? Oh, I went to Melbourne Zoo and I learned about these mound-building birds, and we let them out, and we're clearing they don't have any gardeners anymore, scraping up leaves. They clear them all up. But they're going to expand with the eucalypts and become Californian citizens.
Yeah.
Another American Australian.
Right. Now, when I was at Los Angeles, in the street I saw river gum, baby bark, and then in Santa Cruz I seen coolibah, which is you call a box here, and I seen ironbark, silver leaf ironbark, green leaf ironbark, and then it's a big gum tree like Melbourne got, taking over.
That's right.
And that's what they, I saw. That's what they asked me to recognize, and I recognized it for them.
In the 1850s, there were two wonderful people, a nurseryman in charge, there was Hill in charge of the Botanic Gardens in Brisbane, and Bailey, who was a nurseryman, had been in charge of the Adelaide Botanic Gardens in 1840, but that's irrelevant. What they did was to send specimens of the Moreton Bay, Brisbane area down to the Sydney Botanic Gardens. There were a third of the plantings in the Melbourne Botanic Gardens from the Brisbane area. They went across. Some of them ended up into the San Diego Botanic Gardens. And there's one Moreton Bay fig at Santa Barbara, just at the entrance, and so big that the hippies from all over Canada and the United States come there and pray. The shaman.
Thanks,
Ray.
Thank you, Bill.
Sorry.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm Gifford Miller. So I have an interest in fire regimes and Aboriginal burning, and I recall when Kakadu was created, they initially excluded fire and then eventually realized they could only preserve what was there if they brought the indigenous peoples in to actually use their traditional burning. So I'm curious, to what extent did you have discussion with the Arnhem Landers themselves about when they burnt, why they burnt? You referred to it in a couple of slides, but did you have any lengthy discussions with them on their traditional burning practices?
I didn't, but Margaret MacArthur, of course, because of the food sources and such forth, it was a common practice, and while we were in Yirrkala, it was the peak of the burning season, and, Bert Dagnan, just the birds disappeared. But Hal Walker, Dave Johnson, this quiet, what's he, American?
The
clever man.
Clever man.
He got into them, and he got a lot of the information. But, you know, it's very difficult to check these in the field, but at least now people over at the Kapalga in north of Kakadu, they've been working on one of these programs for years, and the three-year cycle that Dave Johnson seems to be roughly right.
To what extent is the current the vegetation that you saw there, to what extent was that actually determined by the fire regime as opposed to a natural succession which you would see in non-burnt area?
Academy of Science here with Richard Groves, one of my colleagues and students, they did fire and a book on fire in the Australian biota in 1981 was published. And there's a lot of information going back to the indigenous archaeological sites. Climate, we were, as part of this problem, we've been going back with my colleagues to look at climate and changes since for 100 million years in Australia. And, of course, the very recent stuff with the ice ages has been well documented by other people, so that there are certainly periods of bushfire seasons. I was particularly concerned how quickly did the heathland regenerate in the 90-mile desert or 90-mile plain of South Australia between Bordertown and Keith and over into Victoria, and we managed to get stands of the heath 25 years. I go off to, in age, so we know roughly what happened in that time. I go off to Southern California. I was able to get stands of chaparral up to 35 years. After we'd left, they burnt the whole lot. Not they, but it was burnt. And recently, with the California and the Australian bushfires, I was able to go back and look at the dates when these things started. They're coincidental, the El Nino current. Well, that's my interpretation. They occur at the same, roughly within 6 months to a year of each other.
Well, one last one. Yes? Identify yourself.
Sit down.
My name's Deb Sims, and thanks, Ray, for a wonderful presentation. I'm just wondering, of all the fantastic things that came, out of this experience for you, was there something? What was the most surprising thing you discovered from your experience on the expedition?
Everything to me was just so remarkable, and meeting these wonderful scientists, archaeologists, and such. All my career has just been pushed forward like a puppet. But this was just to be on was the most amazing thing. And to experience this remarkable land. And, I could say meeting Kumbiala and for 2 weeks, etc.
That's pretty surprising.
Unbelievable that coincidence would occur. There must be something from above.
Yeah, absolutely.
The dreaming sequence, or whatever you call them.
So, 13,500 species, I guess, specimens, you probably can't isolate one.
I collected some remarkable ones, new ones, around the edge of the sandstone, sometimes. In one, I think, in Bickerton Island, and quite a number around Owen Gully on the eastern side, but they're all related to the sands.
So catch up with him at morning tea time.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.